Well, thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening. Let me welcome you formally to St. Nicholas Cole Abbey. My name is Chris Fishlock. I'm the minister here, and it's great to be able to welcome you to our evening drinks reception and interview. Thank you for joining us indeed. Let me just explain who we are and what we're doing this evening, just in case anybody's wandered in, not completely sure. Who are we? St. Nicholas Cole Abbey, we are a church meeting in the centre of London, represented here tonight a number of different congregations, midweek and Sunday, all with a very simple aim. We want to know the Lord Jesus, and we believe that happens as his word, the Bible, is read and explained. And so at the heart of all of the meetings that take place, we have Bible readings. Every now and then we have small sort of exceptions to that, and we want to hear from people who have come to know Jesus themselves. And tonight, that's what we're doing. We're meeting Simon Pilcher. I'm going to get him up here in a few minutes and ask him a few more questions about what it means to know Jesus here in the city. Now, let me introduce Simon very, very briefly before I get him up here. Simon, I wrote this down, Simon, so I wouldn't make a mistake. Chief Executive, Fixed Income and Alternatives at M&G. I'm interested to know about the alternatives in a few minutes, but we'll come to that. Executive Chairman also of Real Estate. I think that's because he doesn't have enough to do doing the fixed income. So Real Estate to keep you out of trouble. Simon, come and join me up here. Thank you very much indeed for being game to be interviewed. Grab a seat here. We can be relaxed. Now, Simon, we've known each other for some time, and it's been a real joy knowing you, and thank you very much indeed for coming to do this. I remember last summer, I very casually just said to you, "So, Simon, how's the cycling going?" And you told me that you'd cycled over 100 miles before I'd even had the chance to ask you the question. Are you still cycling like that?
I am in training for a 100-mile event, which I do once a year. I'm one of those people who is fundamentally lazy and therefore needs to have an event in the diary that motivates me to actually go and take some exercise periodically, because if I take no exercise, if you just rock up at the start line, you're going to die. I think I operate better when I've taken some exercise, so periodically I'm on my bike.
How many times a week? How many times a month? Just for events.
Do you want the what I aim to do?
Or give us a few stats.
Ideally, I would sort of park commute once or twice a week on the cycle. It's about a 50k round trip if I'm doing it, and then I'd be out at the weekend and do about 100k one day at the weekend.
Well, that immediately means we have less in common than I thought. But let's move on to your family. The pleasure of knowing your family. Rachel, obviously, five children. I think two of your children are now working in the city. Just give us a little bit of an insight into what it's like to have a big family at different stages.
Yeah, so my eldest is Tom. He's 26, just got married to the gorgeous Fliss. I'm allowed to call her gorgeous because she's my daughter-in-law. And then the youngest is Josh, and he is doing GCSEs. We've got GCSEs and A-levels, university second year exams this year. Oh, and CFA 3. By the way, those of you who are doing CFA, you have my genuine admiration and respect and commiserations. I've seen how miserable it is.
How many people are doing CFA at the moment?
Respect.
One.
Commiserations.
Everyone else is studying, I think. So.
Yeah, so we're a big family, physically big. Tom's taller than me. Josh will be shortly. But five of them. And we are very close. My children really, I think, genuinely love being with each other. We spent Saturday at Twickenham at the Sevens, the Rugby Sevens International competition, which was awesome fun. That was Alexander's gift to everyone for Christmas. If you want to do Christmas shopping with a single click of a mouse, take the whole family to an event. They love each other. They love being with each other. They are brutally rude to one another.
Now, tell us, you were telling me about this beforehand, so, you know, the savage humour, I think you called it. Yeah, tell us about the savage humour that exists in the Pilcher family.
Well, I think if you're really confident that you are trusted and loved and secure, then you can be merciless to your sibling or your father, and he can be with you. So yeah, humour basically is about being very rude to one another.
Give us an example of when you've seen that in action, some of the savage humour.
Oh, I don't know. So Tom got married in September. Lovely event. Really, really lovely talk, speeches. In the middle of his speech, he said, "Mum and Dad, thanks so much for having me, but no thanks at all for having Alexander." And we all know that Josh is adopted. At which point, most people are in that sort of shocked. He didn't just say that. And those who know us very well guffawed with laughter, because that is one of the standing jokes.
Now, you've been working in the city for 31 years, I think now, 31 years. Tell us something you love about the city.
I love markets, but I love people. My job these days is really more managing people than managing money. People are more complicated than money, but people are actually much more interesting than money. So, yeah, I enjoy different cultures. I just enjoy understanding how different people groups operate, put a Dutchman in a room with a Japanese person and retire, because it's not going to work very well. Culturally so different, but I enjoy sort of overseeing that and trying to get them to work together.
Well, let's move on to talk about your work a little bit more now. People will have seen a brief bio and understand some of the things you do now. At least most people understand that much better than me. But just explain some of the stepping stones. I think you graduated about 31 years ago, just before you started working. Was it natural sciences you studied?
I did part one natural science and part two management studies.
The obvious follow-up.
Indeed.
And after that, just fill in some of the blanks between graduating Cambridge and arriving at M&G, some of the things that happened in between.
So I got a job immediately working for a firm called Morgan Grenfell Asset Management, as the name suggests, managing money. There were three of us who joined at the time. Stuart spoke fluent French, so he became the French equities manager. Mike had nothing useful. Sorry, he was a history student. So he got Japanese equities, and I had a sort of mathsy, economicsy, nerdy sort of background, so I got nerdy fixed income. Which I was immediately livid with, because equities was the sexy place to be. But a month after starting work, the financial crash of October 87 happened, and fixed income became a very, very good place to be. And I rapidly learned that it suited me to a T. I'm one of the sad people that finds it fascinating. So I worked there for a while, and then in 98, a headhunter called me up and asked me if I would come to be head of fixed income at Prudential. The man recruiting had been my first boss at Morgan Grenfell. And Mike said, when the headhunter came up with my name, "Pilcher, doesn't he wear short trousers?" Which was sort of true, in that I was about 32 at the time. But he saw through the short trousers, and I joined as head of fixed income. Prue bought M&G about a year later, and that's sort of, so it's really all the same. It's my 20th year.
At M&G?
At Prue. M&G, straight Prudential, yeah.
And so, going back to that job title I read out at the beginning, rather long, Chief Executive Fixed Income Alternatives, whatever that means, Executive Chairman of Real Estate. Give us a flavour for what that actually entails.
So it started out in fixed income. So we manage money on behalf of pension funds, insurance companies and such like. Fixed income is essentially lending money. But we're not bankers. They're obviously evil and we're good people. Glad you've all understood the distinction. So that then rapidly expanded as we did more private debt and then moved into things like infrastructure debt and then infrastructure equity and then restructuring and then... I was latterly then, this year, asked to take overall responsibility for our real estate division. So Prudential is the second largest owner of real estate in the UK.
And so the way that cash is out, day to day, if I remember correctly, about 500 people under your direct responsibility, quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of the pressures that involves. Besides the obvious?
It's responsible. I mean, we're clearly making big decisions and wanting to make good decisions for our clients. I am, though, someone who temperamentally is able to compartmentalize, but also am firmly of the view that my wife does a far more important job than I do in terms of looking to raise our children to know and love the Lord, and that that is of greater eternal significance than what I do. But my job is more about managing people these days than money. It's about determining the strategy. Where are we headed? What types of business are we going to take on? How are we going to develop the business? Hiring people, firing people, hopefully less of the latter than the former.
Now, you're really here this evening, as far as I'm concerned, because I want to talk to you about your Christian faith. And we're going to come on to that in just a moment. But just before we do, just a little bit more on your work. Just maybe you could give us a flavor for some of the highs that you've experienced over the last 30 years, some of the lows. Tell us about some of the high points.
There was an amazing afternoon, not long after joining Prudential, when we won two, in the context of the day, enormous mandates. To win one in a year would have been a fantastic. One was £1 billion, which even 20 years ago was quite a lot of money. The second was only £400 million. But we won two mandates in that one afternoon. And I said to Pam, my colleague, Pam, remember this, because you'll never have an afternoon like it again. And I was right, we haven't. But that was an amazing moment. The reality is we have won lots of different mandates and bigger ones than that. An amazing high, but actually the high of that sort of fades quite quickly and ultimately isn't that exciting. Lows, about 9 months after I joined, Prue bought M&G, paid a lot of money for M&G, and the deal basically was, we're buying your management team. And the management team that I joined was essentially lined up against a wall and shot. Not literally, of course, but a couple of us escaped. That was quite sobering. That was quite quite a gulp moment. Second, well, I'm not sure whether it's a low or a high or how to describe it, but if you cast your mind back to the financial crisis, I had an amazing financials analyst, and Tamara did an outstanding job at understanding what was going on and seeing where it was headed. And we could see that we were headed genuinely very rapidly towards no banking system, no financial system, total economic collapse. We had conversations with Number 10, I won't go into them, but genuinely the world was on the edge of a precipice. And Tamara said to me, Simon, I don't get you, because you understand, unlike most people, you understand what's happening, and you're not panicking. Why is that? And I said to her, well, Tamara, ultimately my status and my security is not bound up in my job, my job title, my nice environment, my pension even, which could have disappeared down a plug hole. That is not what makes me tick. That is not what defines me. We may well lose it all, but that is not what life is about.
Well, let's move on to that. That's a nice sort of entry into Christian life. Now, I think, like many in this country, you grew up going to a church school. Just tell us a little bit about what you thought of the Christian message. What were you like back then, pre-adult life? So we're back at sort of church school days. What were you, Simon Pilcher, like back then?
I was the most arrogant young man I think you'll ever meet. I was bright and knew it. But I think what was really insufferable was my conceitedness about who I was and how convinced I was. Well, I honestly thought that the biggest problem of the world was that nobody was as nice as me. Which tells you quite a lot about how deluded I was, but it tells you about how arrogant I was. What was my view of Christianity? My view of Christianity was that, it was sort of a good thing. I was generally in favour of it. We went along to church, but it had no real connection to me. I just didn't compute.
And what about Christians? What did you make of Christians back then? So we're talking about your teenage years now?
Yeah, there were some nice people, but it was fine for them.
Okay.
Yeah, fine for them.
They could learn from you.
Yeah, probably.
Now, obviously that changed. You became a Christian. Tell us about that change. How did that come about?
So I was invited. My mother conspired with my uncle to invite me onto a Christian holiday camp in the summer. And so it was sort of 10 days with a bunch of other teenagers playing a load of sport, which I loved, in the Dorset countryside. And I had a fantastic time. Morning and evening, we heard short Christian talks explaining the heart of the Christian faith. And I remember it being explained that I'm a rebel, that we're all rebels, that I'd treated God as if he didn't exist, and that I needed his forgiveness, and that Jesus had died on the cross in order to pay the punishment that I deserved for rejecting God, for treating him as if he was dirt. And I'd heard the message, and I was very impressed by the leaders, because these were senior, some of them were people who might be in this room, you know, people with high-paid jobs who'd given up their holidays. They weren't being paid to be on that Christian holiday camp. They were effectively paying to be there in order to look after snot rags like me. And I was very impressed by this, and one of them took me out for a Dorset cream tea, and he said to me, "Simon, have you ever prayed the prayer which had been explained the night before, whereby you ask God for his forgiveness and commit your life to Jesus?" And I knew what answer he wanted to hear, and I wanted to humor him, so I gave him the answer that he wanted to hear. "Oh yes, I've prayed that prayer." When did you do that? Well, the lies just multiplied, because the trouble is, when you start lying about something like that, you get in deeper and deeper. And I had to admit to myself and to God that night that I was not the nice person I thought I was. I had to admit that I was someone who was deeply flawed and who had completely ignored him and was in desperate need of forgiveness. So I was 14.
And that night, what would you say went through your mind? Deeply convicted? Deeply? What sort of different truths were going through your mind? Because you'd heard a lot through the Christian camp, obviously.
Yeah. I think it was just basically that. I had to admit that I was not this nice person, that I'd been deluding myself that I was just like everybody else. Not particularly worse than anybody else, but not better than anybody else, but definitely not someone who deserved to be God's friend, because I treated him as if he didn't exist. I mean, imagine treating your parents as if they didn't exist, giving them not the time of day. And that was the conviction I had. And then I think a measure of relief at the idea of that I was okay to admit that that's who I was and that God knew it in any case, and astonishment that God could forgive me, that he would accept me as his son, even though I treated him like dirt.
So you said sorry. You prayed the prayer, to use the language you used just now. What happened the next day?
Oh, I went about the day as normal. Played lots of sport. Listened to the talks a bit more carefully. But it felt pretty much as I had the day before. There's no sort of flashing lights or amazing anything. Yeah. Sorry, is that disappointing?
It's real. That's what happens. But I know that as you then sort of grew up in your Christian life, you then started to look at some of the questions that began to sort of interest you. And I remember we were talking a little bit about some of the sort of questions around science and the resurrection. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so look, I did science at A level, and I did a bit of science at university, geology, metallurgy, other fun things like that. And I think if you're remotely inquisitive, you've got to try and hold together. Well, is there a conflict between science and Christianity? Do they contradict one another? And so that's something I looked into in considerable depth, and I'm absolutely convinced that there is no conflict whatsoever. I have no problem personally believing in a universe that's 14 billion odd years old. I have no problem reconciling that with a high view of the Bible. That's an issue that I've looked at.
What do you mean by a high view of the Bible? What does that mean?
I think that when I read the Bible, I'm reading God's words that are of eternal relevance and of eternal, they're eternally true. And so when I read the Bible, I'm asking not how does it measure up against how I view the world, but what does it say of the world, and how do I need to change my views to accommodate how God sees the world, how God sees me? And so that's an issue that clearly I've grappled with. Mm-hmm. The other issue that I really needed to get to grips with was the resurrection. And I'll say it now, if someone can disprove the events of AD 33, when Jesus, it's claimed, was raised from the dead, if someone can prove that he was not raised from the dead, then I will quit being a Christian that instant. Because Christianity rises, stands or falls on the resurrection of Jesus. And the great thing about Christianity is, I think it's unique amongst all world religions. It's falsifiable. What I mean by that is that it claims to be based on historical evidence and on historical events, which can be investigated using normal historical methods. And we can learn from those historical evidence as to whether Jesus existed. Well, trust me, there is oodles of evidence that Jesus existed, that he died. And again, I think there is oodles of evidence that Jesus died. The real question is, was he raised from the dead? And if he was raised from the dead, then his claims that he made before he died, not only that he was God, but that he would be killed and be raised from the dead, then you have to take those claims seriously. But if he was not raised from the dead, then you have to say, well, Jesus was either a deluded idiot or a liar, or that he was trying to manipulate us in some way. Mm. And at which case Christianity falls apart completely. So the resurrection is, to my way of thinking, the single most significant event in history, and the event that every person on this planet needs to think about and ask, is it true? By the way, I think it is.
Now, as you've gone on in the Christian life, I mean, obviously there are ups and downs, as there always are in these things. Tell us about some of the things that really excite you for being a Christian today. What are some of the things you sort of look forward to and enjoy about the Christian life?
Oh, I think the most exciting thing is to see somebody else realize that God sent his son to die for them, and that they must put their trust in him. There is nothing more exciting as a Christian than to see somebody else come to faith. We talked about my children. We've had the joy in the last 3 weeks of my three youngest, in context they are 20, about to be 18 on Thursday, and 16. My three youngest stand up and make a very clear personal declaration of their own adult faith and be baptized. It's their faith, it's not my faith, it's something that they have now clearly said, this is where I stand at school, at university, in the rugby club, this is who I am. And so that for me is the most exciting thing. What I also love seeing is that Christianity makes sense of life, and that it works right the way through life, and it holds up in the face of death. And so my mother, the one who conspired to send me to that Christian holiday camp, my mother died in July. Mum had Alzheimer's. She'd had Alzheimer's for about 10 years, gradual decline. And about 3 months before she died, she lost the ability to speak. Probably 2 months before she died, she lost the ability to speak. Maybe 3 months before she died, my father, I mean, she was very, very limited in terms of what she could do or say or eat at that point. And my father was trying to reassure her of how much she was loved. And, you know, Sally, you do know how much I love you, and you do know how much your sisters and brothers love you. You know how much your children love you. And Mum replied to him as if to say, well, I don't know about any of that. She said, I know the Lord loves me. And that was pretty much the last thing she said, was able to say. And she died with a very, very clear conviction that she was headed to be with her Saviour. Not because of what she'd done, not because she's a good person, but because she understood that the Lord loved her and the Lord had sent his son to die for her, and that Christianity just makes sense of life from the beginning and to the end, and you know, seeing it lived out, seeing a faithful saint die in the Lord is a real privilege.
Now, obviously, you're known within M&G as a Christian by many. What do your colleagues make of that?
Mixed. So there are a number of other Christians in M&G, and that's great. And I want to encourage them. And I'm very out in terms of being a Christian. So I think they are encouraged to stand firm themselves, because I'm a bit more high profile in sort of both work context and perhaps Christian context. Some I know despise me for it. I won't mention details. But
well, actually, there was one case.
He didn't. Alan was a bit different. Alan was a former colleague who was chief technology officer, and Alan said, "I'm not sure if he really thought what he was saying, but he said, Simon, I used to think you were quite intelligent, and then I heard you're a Christian, which was wonderful." I said, Alan, we must have lunch. Come on, we need to talk about this, because I think that there is solid evidence here and you need to confront it. So we had lunch and we had a really good chat, but he didn't want to take it any further. I think he was a bit scared.
Now, there'll be lots of people here who don't necessarily share your convictions, share your view of the Christian faith. One of the things that we said on the invitation tonight, the question, let me get it right here, is belief in Jesus a good investment? I mean, why don't you answer that question? Is belief in Jesus a good investment? Tell us a little bit.
So, completely coincidentally, I was speaking in our home church yesterday on a passage that absolutely speaks to this question. We're going through Luke's gospel from beginning to end. It's going to take all year. And I was given Luke chapter 9. And I had to speak on this yesterday. You're going to hear some of the verses that I had to preach on yesterday.
When you say you had to preach on, you
well,
didn't...
Well, okay, I'm part of the preaching team, and I was just given... It just completely coincidental.
You really don't have enough to do at M&G, do you? So you've got a little bit of Sunday preaching as well. Very good. Tell us what you said yesterday.
Well, let me read you these verses. So Jesus is just... Peter has just worked out who Jesus is. So Peter has just realized that Jesus is God's king. He is the king that God had promised throughout history he would send to rescue his people. And he then is told by Jesus that he, Jesus, is going to die, that he's going to be rejected, that he's going to be killed, and that he's going to be raised to life again. And then Jesus says to his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself?" So imagine you are Warren Buffett. Imagine you are, for you students of antiquity, King Croesus, who was reputed... He's the one who was so rich. Well, it doesn't really matter who he was. But imagine you are mind-bogglingly rich and you die. What do you take with you? You take nothing. You take absolutely nothing with you. How rich we are now is of zero account when it comes to fronting up to God. Because will he let me into his heaven? Well, I can't bribe him. I can't take the money with me in any case. And the analogy I used yesterday was to say, imagine you're on a ship. Let's call it the Titanic. And you're on the Titanic and you're sailing across the North Atlantic and the Titanic hits an iceberg. And it's clear that the ship is going down. And the captain tells you that the ship is going down and there's a lifeboat. And the captain instructs you to get into the lifeboat. And he says to you, "You need to get into that lifeboat. Simon, you need to get into that lifeboat." And you can see as the water's sort of about to come over the decks that the ship is really about to go down. But you know that on that ship is just the most incredible treasure trove. There's gold bars, there's diamonds, there's rubies. And you've got the option to go and stuff your pockets full of all this treasure. The only problem is you haven't got time to do that and get on to the lifeboat. So what are you going to do? You could be the richest man on the ship and go down with the ship. You could be the richest man on the planet and go down with the ship. Or you get on the lifeboat. And Jesus is offering a lifeboat. Jesus is offering an eternal rescue for men and women who have no means of rescuing ourselves. There is no way I can bridge the gap between me and God. And Jesus is offering that rescue. So, is Jesus a good investment? Of course he is. It's not only that actually living as a Christian in this life is genuinely the best life that there is now, and it is, I'm utterly convinced of it, but it's also for eternity, it's the only investment. There is no other investment because my pension is of eternal uselessness and my savings will achieve nothing. So it's not only for the here and now, and I genuinely think that living the Christian life is the best life, but for eternity, it's the only one. Jesus says, you're a fool. How could you not make that investment? Will you put your trust in him, or will you chase after things of this world? Now, some of us are fortunate that we work in an industry where we get paid more than we need, and it's not that I've gone searching to be well off. I just happen to be well off. I don't have to keep it all. But is is what was the question?
Is belief in Jesus a good investment?
Yeah, well, yes. Yes, Chris. Yes.
Thank you. Well, we could have got to that a bit quicker, really, couldn't we? But